families of murder victims and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherished Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherished Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherished Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was an ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I had in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue? So we came together as we do, who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherished Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered. It is not a Catholic service because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes. We had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. One of the surprising things about these services, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured. So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19, was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, The judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year. And we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith, in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for, and clearly being abused, and they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the three children played with the dog. They owned it. They loved it. And when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag. And she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set, but that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal." He said, "I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog." And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person, and the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps. And there was a young boy, all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child. And I said, "Honey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "My mama sent me." I said, "But do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered." "How old was he?" "He was 15. My mom is sick. She couldn't come, so she sent me." "How did you get here?" "I took two trains." Boy, I was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list. And we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook, and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him, but he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more
No,
about him?
nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy, from New York City.